You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
ESPN Audio and SC Featured presents a 16-episode podcast, Pin Kings. It's the story of two All-American high school wrestlers, teammates, and friends who ultimately ended up on the opposite sides of the war on drugs. Pin Kings is for mature audiences. Welcome to Episode 10, Bimini and Beyond.
I was with Alex once in Coconut Grove at the fancy house of another drug smuggler. And there was a beautiful girl laying by the pool who Alex was hugely impressed with. And we took her out for a boat ride. They started dating, and within 18 months or so, they had a beautiful son.
This is Scott Chiraus, a friend and former smuggling partner of Alex DeCubis's.
It was difficult to be doing all the things we were doing and be married. It seemed that there was a conflict there. I remember he had a wonderful wedding, chartered a really cool yacht. We had a great time. And then the next day it was like, man, we got to gear up. We got a load coming in. And his wife was not happy that he canceled the honeymoon, or said, well, maybe you could take your sister on the honeymoon. Didn't go over real well.
Kevin and Alex were best friends. Champion wrestling buddies.
The heydays of Miami.
Alex DeCubis was clearly a kingpin.
It's a tragic story.
The less you know, the more you leave.
I wanted to take out the biggest drug dealers.
If they ever catch him, he's going away for the rest of his life. If they don't kill him when they try to capture him.
Could you imagine if Kevin has to shoot Alex? He's a sworn federal agent for a drug enforcement agency.
Evil goes to jail, or evil ends up dead.
Welcome to the SC Featured podcast, Pin Kings. I'm Brett Forrest, a senior writer at ESPN The Magazine.
And my name is John Fish. I'm a producer for ESPN. And at the end of last episode, Julio Cesar Nasser David, the head of the North Coast Cartel in Colombia, has summoned Alex.
Alex gets on the plane for South America.
Back in those days, if you were a drug trafficker in the U.S., the one thing you didn't want was a Colombian stamp in your passport.
Right, because the cops, if they looked at it, they'd
right
know.
Right away.
Hey, this guy's in the wrong place.
So Alex flies to Venezuela, and two of Julio Cesar Nasser David's men pick him up at the airport.
And they drive him along this highway. We drove down that highway too, at least part ways. And it's a beautiful highway along the ocean, along in the northern coastal region of Colombia. The drive takes several hours. They end up in Barranquilla, which is the base of the North Coast Cartel.
These guys drive Alex to a Middle Eastern restaurant. The place is closed down. There are about 30 guys out front, all armed. Alex walks inside.
And inside,
he didn't really want to go to this, by the way.
No, but he walks in. There's a long table in the middle of the restaurant. It's piled high with Middle Eastern food. There are a couple of belly dancers. Alex takes a seat. Door opens in the back, and in walks Julio Cesar Nasser David, the old man.
Everybody called him the old man.
And to Alex's surprise, this Nasser guy is polite, gracious, soft-spoken even.
He came off as a gentleman businessman, and they ate and they saw eye to eye.
Alex went down to meet with Julio Cesar Nasser David, and he came back. He said, well, one, the guy has this name like a Roman emperor. and he even looks a little bit like a Roman emperor.
This is Scott Schraus.
He was impressed with it. He said, the guy has his own graveyard. You know, he took me out to a hill and he's pointing at this and he's like, makes no issue out of having people killed and this, but now he wants to do this giant load.
John, Julio Cesar Nasser David, as big as this guy was, he was the head of a cartel in Colombia. He needed Alex DeCubis. He needed a transportation specialist who could carry that load the last step into the U.S. He had a guy, but he was unhappy with it. This guy had been underperforming. Everybody knew this guy as the Zombie.
Zombie.
He's a legendary figure for the people who knew him back.
Everybody has a nickname. The one thing that you'll see as the story goes along is there's a nickname for everybody.
Yeah, nobody wanted to know anybody's last name, and it was better if you didn't know the first name either. Anyway, this guy, the Zombie, after each score, well, this is how he got his nickname. After each score, he would take the money that he'd earned, he'd buy an enormous amount of heroin, and he'd hole up in his house. He'd just get totally whacked out. And when the money ran out, that's when the Zombie would resurface again and do another operation.
Well, Nasser needed someone who was dependable, and he saw what a lot of people had always seen in Alex. He was a man of his word. He was a tough guy who wasn't going to get pushed around. He was someone that could command an operation with a lot of people under him. He was a leader. Uh-huh. Alex had always been a leader, just like he was in wrestling. He just brought that with him.
Paul Pelletier, the federal prosecutor who led this case, he explains it pretty well.
He developed a very trusted relationship with Julio Nasser. In the drug business, trust is the coin of the realm.
Soon after their meeting, we're talking 1986, Alex and Julio Nasser start planning their first operation together. Of course, it involved the Bahamas.
The Bahamas had been the staging ground for cocaine and the cocaine trade for a long time.
Well, they kind of reference it as a corruptible government. It was a very loose atmosphere over there.
Yeah. Yeah, and the traffickers, they'd always flown product directly from Colombia to the U.S., and they would land on remote airfields, but these loads were limited by the capacity of the planes, and the fact that these flights originated in Colombia could sometimes cause problems.
Well, the Bahamas are right off of the coast of Florida. If you look at a map, it's pretty staggering when you realize that the Bahamian island of closest to the Florida coast is Bimini. It's about 50 miles from Miami. It was tailor-made for Colombians to hand off their packages to the American transportation specialists.
Well, the Bahamas is a key link in this whole thing. It's a 700 islands scattered over 100,000 square miles, and it's just perfect for smuggling. It was just the perfect place combined with the giant coastline of Florida. What's not to like?
Bring it in to Bimini.
That was Scott Schraus. Bimini and the Bahamas, as a whole, they weren't just close, they were also easily bought.
The police chief on Bimini was a guy by the name of Glenn Roll.
Glenn Roll, legendary figure in the trade.
They call him the sheriff.
Right.
He became kind of a de facto partner of drug organizations that used his territory to transit cocaine. There was an airstrip there, the cartels would fly the drugs to Bimini, and the pilot would either land there, where the transport group would pay Glenn Roll about $40,000 for use of the airstrip, or just do an airdrop off the coast.
Right, and if there were ever any problems, sometimes there were. Sometimes the police there would seize your airplane, for example. But Glenn Roll could solve all your problems. Again, Scott Schraus.
It was also interesting how easy it was to do business there, illegal business. We'd deal with Glenn Roll in Bimini, and through him, pay off the police in that area. And you could get your airplane back, you could get your people out of prison, and in the perfect world, you could sometimes buy your cocaine back. The Bahamas, everything seemed surmountable.
The Bahamas were perfect for a guy like Julio Nasser. He had always had massive operations in mind.
And he let Alex in on his new plan.
The Nerma was a 50-foot freighter that plied the waters of the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico with regular cargo. And it was the perfect way to smuggle cocaine, because if you ever saw it, you would never expect that slow, big freighter was going to be smuggling huge amounts of cocaine into South Florida.
That was Paul Pelletier, the former federal prosecutor. Julio Nasser, he had pioneered the use of coastal freighters to smuggle marijuana.
You almost need a ship that size if you're going to do substantial loads of pot because pot is bulky.
What Nasser did is he just changed the cargo from this low margin, as you said, bulky marijuana, now to this compact, highly profitable cocaine. Now the NIRMA would enable him and his North Coast cartel to ship tons of cocaine at a time.
The NIRMA had a route to Jacksonville from Colombia. I heard stories that, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, they called the ship the good ship Lollipop.
That was Jim Burke of the Boca Raton Police Department. The NIRMA carried legitimate cargo, and the papers were in order. It looked completely legit.
Great idea.
Full Danish crew. There was no reason that you would suspect this huge coastal freighter that was carrying anything but legitimate cargo.
Right. And by June 88, Alex DeCubis was orchestrating his first offload of the NIRMA.
There were about 1,200 kilos aboard. 1.3 tons worth about $18 million.
If we can go into some...
Cocaine 101?
Yeah, exactly. But the numbers are fascinating because at that point, grams of cocaine often were selling for about $90 retail. But see, that's after they were stepped on, you know, in the parlance. That's basically cutting in half. How would you say?
You take a pure product yeah. and you dilute it to make more of it.
And they would usually, back in those days, they would add lidocaine. The resulting product that someone would buy on the street would be half cocaine, half lidocaine, but no one could really tell the difference. So at retail, a kilo could be worth as much as $90,000, which would have made the first NIRMA load worth, on the street, $108 million.
But it really fluctuated. It was a matter of what you could get for it, and they kept using the NIRMA. The loads kept increasing. And as Nasser pushed for more product, here's Scott Strauss.
Up until that point, the 600 kilos was a big, big load. The idea of 6, 8, 10,000 kilos, you know, almost 25,000 pounds of coke, that's like a bedroom in a house, floor to ceiling, wall to wall of cocaine.
And that's just an absurd amount of money. And it was all running through Alex. He was commanding this major operation. He was coordinating a series of vessels to meet in the ocean in the Bahamas in the middle of the night.
We would meet off of the Berry Islands.
This is David Lemieux, part of Alex's crew.
The NIRMA would slow down to about 4 or 5 knots. We'd pull up alongside, throw the ropes up, and they had a net with a crane. They'd have it already full with all the bundles. You'd swing it out to the side, drop it down on the lobster boat, get the net out of the way, cut the two lines that were rafted off to them, and away we'd go. We'd head back to the island. The NIRMA would keep its route.
What would you do with the product once you had it in the smaller boats?
Once we got back into the islands, we'd have go-fasts or hidden compartment boats, whichever it was that was going to carry this stuff. We'd dole it out. I'd keep track of, like, this guy would get 500. All right, Billy Bob got 500. Ray Jerry got 300, whatever they could hold. I'd give Alex the paperwork. And the guys, some of them were in Palm Beach. Some of them were in the Keys. They were all over. They'd bring it in. And from then on, Alex was in charge of keeping track of who got what. And, you know, I did basically all the work in the Bahamas.
Where was Alex when the offloading was going on?
In Miami. He never came over.
Why not?
Well, because he had the record. At the time, everybody didn't want to really go to the Bahamas if you already had a guilty on stuff.
So during the operation, was he communicating with you?
Towards the end, yeah, we actually had a phone that could work over there. For a long time, no. You know, this was back in the day when a cell phone was the Motorola brick. You know, a big thing, and there was no coverage whatsoever over in the Bahamas. But the last couple of times, you know, it finally worked. I finally get done in the middle of the night or whatever, and the next morning I'd get somewhere, and, you know, I'd call them and say, yep, everything's sweet.
Once the boats had secured the cocaine in their hidden compartments, they would make the run into South Florida. Jim Burke of the Boca PD explains.
Now, the boats would not come in the same inlet. They would try to spread out. One might come into Miami, one might come into Jupiter, one might come into Boca Raton, into Florida, into Fort Lauderdale. It's just whatever. You're not going to have all three loaded vessels come in the same inlet, they're going to say. And they also had security, another boat, which Alex might have been in, watching the whole thing, and just to make sure that, you know, hey, there's nothing, no law enforcement is in the area.
Where do the drugs go from there?
They would bring them into warehouses, people's houses, people who lived on the intercoastal. We had part of our investigation where Alex was part of owning a farm in Ocala, and they would use white vans and transport the drugs to Ocala, Florida, offload it in a barn, store it there, and then distribute it, you know, through to Detroit, Chicago, North Carolina. It all depends.
Okay, by this point, Yarmir John, the Czech guy, remember? Remember him from the Cali prison? He comes back into the picture because, if you remember, it was JJ who had gotten Alex involved in ripping. And then he himself, JJ, subsequently served some prison time. So now he's back out. And Alex is a huge operator by this point. So JJ goes to work for Alex. So things sort of flip-flop there. And he's doing a number of things for him.
Security.
Yeah, running security. He's helping to offload the product. He's finding stash houses. Here's JJ.
We go on a Bayview Drive, rent a place. I go over there with my English and say, hey, my mother and parents coming from Czech. We need this house over here. Impress the family. I need a dock. My father is a captain, blah, 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 blah. So we go stuff like this. Bring the load. A small boat comes to the boat and we're supposed to offload it, so we smoke a joint and how we gonna do it? Man, take this fucking kill. Boom, we start throwing kilos out of the boat like a football into garage. Well, after 50 kilos, you ain't throwing no more. You know, it gets tough. So you get diving bags and drag it and then laugh about it and really neighbors not around. It's like we offload 500 kilos an hour, another 500 kilos, and then we smoke another joint and eat something, offload another 100 kilo, 200, 500, and to turn around, you got a 2,000 kilo in a garage. So it was like a no big deal. Hey, get this boat out of here because it's been doing business. Okay, another boat comes in the morning, we wait for the night, offload some more. Put it in a house and I'm staying in the house. When we move the kilos out of the house, we cannot use it no more. We go get these go-go dancing girls. I say, hey, I need some girls and children and some action around this house. You got all the coke, all the food. Oh, yeah, we can move in.
If you couldn't tell, JJ was describing how they would offload cocaine from a boat into a safe house along the coast of Florida.
But once they pack the goods into the safe houses, then they're able to plug the product into their distribution.
So they smuggle the drugs in, and then they sell the drugs.
And that generates a ton of cash.
And it enables everybody in the crew to get into some interesting things. David Lemieux gets into horse racing, race cars. He and his partner bought a horse, Chetsky. He handed it over to the trainer and just said, hey, do something with this.
Right, right. And the first time they go see it race, the horse wins.
So I'm like, yeah, this is pretty cool, owning a horse. I didn't realize it would be that big of a thrill because I drag raced for years and, you know, winning a drag race was pretty neat. But man, these horses turn for home. Chetsky grabs the lead and just kept pulling away down the stretch. Man, your hair's standing up on your arms and you're like, oh my God, this is wild. And he went ahead and wee-weed on the field and just ran away with it, and we made a lot of money. Kept the limo all night, went to High Lie that night, and just kept partying. I guess we bought probably three or four more horses after that, and they all won for us. They all won.
David has this great picture. One of his horses has won the race. They're in the winner's circle as a group. There's David, there's Alex, the biggest pot smuggler in Florida, and there's one of the Cali cartel brothers. He said the feds would have loved to have seen this one.
Remember O.C. Davis? Alex had met him at Club Fed in Eglin. So he has this marina that serviced boats.
O.C.'s marina. Play on his name.
But it was really just a front for their smuggling business. But not everybody knew that, John. Here's David Lemieux.
That was pretty crazy, the Miami Vice boats. I was running boats in the show for them, and the marina at OC's, we took care of the well crafts that Wellcraft had given Miami Vice these boats to use. And as a matter of fact, Don Johnson had one, ran it out of oil, and it seized up. So he calls us up on a, I guess it was a Friday or Saturday, to come over and, hey, I need this boat running to get over there. I said, well, once I see it, it's locked up. I said, you know, what'd you do? Nothing. I said, did it have oil pressure? No, I thought the gauge was bad.
This is Don Johnson?
Yeah.
So Don Johnson called you and said, come fix my boat.
Yeah, it was pretty bizarre, but you didn't think of it at the time, you know? You didn't think that, okay, these guys are showing how they capture the bad guys and we're the bad guys.
How's that for life imitating art, imitating life? And Don Johnson has no idea.
Okay, and then things go and they take a step beyond into the surreal. When David Lemieux, the drug boat runner, gets on the other side of the camera.
A matter of fact, we did a lot of work on the Miami Vice boats. I filmed a few episodes too where they'd lease the boats from us, pay us $1,000 a day. We'd bring the boats and we'd run different scenes all day long.
I love this. When we were interviewing David Lemieux, we were like, hey, Miami Vice, you know, what did you think about it? And he's like, oh yeah, the opening sequence of Miami Vice, which is iconic to this day, depicting the culture and excess of Miami in the drug years. At one point, the producers added a shot of a line of boats racing towards the city, going under this very famous bridge. Here's David Lemieux.
It was the very opening of the show, the scene where they're all coming under the bridge, like eight boats, played in the beginning of every show.
Are you in one of those boats?
Yeah.
You yourself are mm-hmm. piloting that mm-hmm. boat.
Yeah, the wing boat. Yep. They're just showing them from behind. You know, they had a helicopter coming right up behind you with, filming. Matter of fact, we filmed all day one day, and it was a nasty day. And we put the boat in from the trailer at 79th Street Boat Ramp. And so I'm blasting back up the bay, and I hear this, and I'm like, man, what is that? I thought, you know, broke something in the engine. I turn around, there's a Coast Guard chopper, like 30 feet off the deck, right on our butt. You know, I guess we looked like we were bringing in a load or something. So I get back to the dock at 79th Street and they're waiting for us. And what are you doing out? And I said, we're down filming Miami Vice. You know, we're going to search the boat. Yeah, search away. You know, it was pretty crazy.
So Alex continues to orchestrate loads off the Nerma through the Bahamas. They've built up to about 5,500 kilos, which is 6 tons of pure Colombian cocaine.
Alex is responsible for hundreds of millions of dollars of product. And he's enjoying this. He's enjoying the money. He's buying cars, motorcycles. He's got a bunch of boats.
Wave runners.
He buys an airplane. He's a regular at the strip clubs in Miami. There are women all around them. It should come as no surprise that Alex, at this point, has separated from his wife.
And he's also making regular runs to Chicago. Not only does he have a distribution network set up there, but he and his old friend Sam Frontera from the Ripping Days have opened a nightclub.
Now, this was Sam's idea, to buy and refurbish a place called the Riviera Theater. And it's on the north side of Chicago. I don't think Sam and Alex have an interest in it anymore. At that time, it was really a laundry for them. It was a way to run their dirty drug money in one end and have it come out clean on the other. Or
that was the theory. That's where Alex ran into Nicole Tristani. She has a nickname. They called her Nikki the Knife.
That's quite a nickname. You don't forget that one.
Here's Paul Pelletier.
Nicole Tristani was a woman that Alex met in his visits to Chicago and his visits to gentlemen clubs and his visits to jello wrestling clubs. Nikki Tristani was a famous jello wrestler from Chicago.
What is a jello wrestling club?
Far from me to know what a jello wrestling club is. However, what I've learned is that jello wrestling is a bunch of women who wrestle in a big pool of jello. And I believe Nikki had achieved some level of stardom in the jello wrestling industry in Chicago.
How did she get her nickname, Nikki the Knife?
She got her nickname, Nikki the Knife, because allegedly, and she confirmed it with me, but she stabbed a person at Wrigley Field and cut him pretty good outside of Wrigley Field. Not sure the exact circumstances, but certainly I understand she was arrested for that. She was a tough girl.
So Nikki moves down to Miami and the two start dating.
I think there was something about a Harley Davidson. We'll let Jeremy or John tell the story.
Nikki was 19 years old, really sharp. Nikki's fancy. Nikki's a tough girl. Nikki can fight. Nikki's no joke. He said, hey, I want this for this girl, Nikki, I want a Harley. All right, so he gets a Harley, blue, white, whatever it was. I want a pink. So I mix this pink color, white and red, make pink. They go, no, man, I want a hot pink. I came out of the prison. I don't know what's a hot pink and hot, you know, highlighter, the green. I have no hot pink exist. So he took me to the store and showed me hot pink. There was like a $50 or $100 small can of hot pink. That's what you want on a bike? Girl's got that on her fingernail. Beautiful girl. A small helmet. She sits on it. I say, hey, if that bike gets on the ground and you can lift it up, then you can ride it. Nikki gets to it and wrestles that Harley straight up. Okay? She gets it up to Nikki. I say, all right. So I paint the bike for you. We took all the parts out and we painted it hot pink. There was fenders, the oil thing. Everything was hot pink. When the girl gets on that bike, there was like hot pink fingernails, hot pink helmet, and hot pink bike. There was like, you never see a girl and a Harley and a combination like this. It was so beautiful. It was really, really hot. She pulls up in Miami and it was like jaw-dropping deal.
So Alex had found the woman for him.
But now he was finding himself at odds with the old man in Barranquilla, Julio Nasser.
Remember, Nasser was the guy who liked to set records?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Not that anybody was keeping records for cocaine smuggling, but he was the guy who'd sent the barge of marijuana up the Mississippi River, hundreds of thousands of pounds of pot.
Yep, that was
he
him.
He always wanted to smuggle more and more. Now this is creating a conflict for Alex.
Yeah, because Alex had a really tight crew. A lot of these guys who worked with him and worked for him, they were ex-wrestlers, ex-football players, got a lot of guys that he knew from Miami or Georgia. You know, some guys he would just say, hey, can you help offload this? Or other guys would get really involved. These were guys he could trust. He was comfortable with these guys.
Well, Nasser tells him he's going to increase the size of the load, and Alex understands that this will exceed the size of his organizational capacity. He doesn't have enough boats in his crew to handle that amount. The old man wants to send to the Bahamas more and more and more. He tells Nasser this.
But instead of decreasing the size of the load, Nasser suggests that Alex just take on another boat.
So David Lemieux finds a guy.
And this guy was an informant.
Panther, this is Swordfish 04. Request to know if you have any Charlies out here tonight. Over.
They're open fishing boat type vessels. Okay, here we have a coastal freighter
moving straight in toward our vessels. Over. All right, Panther from 04. We have the subject. Copy. Over.
Holy, they got a party going on down there. Okay, zoom in on him.
Ooh, what a picture.
Is that narrow? That's him.
It's the dark of night. They're out to sea. There is no natural light anywhere. The Coast Guard plane is overhead. It's shooting the Nirma offload with an infrared camera.
Alex's crew is executing an operation. But David Lemieux, he knows something's not right.
I heard a plane, and I knew we weren't in the flight path. I was like, man, I wonder, you know, what is that? You could hear it, like it was circling, but it was supposed to be high enough we wouldn't hear it. But I knew right then, I said, man, let's pick the pace up. And we're humping, getting that stuff in there. And that's when I said, we gotta move. You know, something's up. You don't know what it is.
What did that tell you?
That the gig was up.
Thank you for listening to the SC Featured Podcast, Pin Kings. You can follow Pin Kings on Twitter at ESPN Pin Kings. That's at ESPN Pin Kings. A preview of the next episode follows this message.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Next on Pin Kings, episode 11, Nowhere to Hide.
As a military officer, I couldn't have drugs. I would not have drugs, illegal drugs around me at all.
I know that he was kind of near making a bad choice.
I took out a Colt Commander 9mm that I had acquired in the Army, and I was going to blow my head off.
Don't miss an episode. You can listen and subscribe to the Pin Kings podcast in the ESPN app or download and listen on Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to rate this podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts.